Shall we begin?
Let's begin now.
You're listening to the Dishin' and Swishin' podcast on HoopFeed.com.
Hi, everybody. It's David Siegel welcoming you to a Final Four edition of the Dishin' and Swishin' podcast. And if it's time for the Final Four, then it's time for me to have a wonderful guest. Doug Bruno joins us for the third consecutive year to talk about the Final Four. Coach, how are you?
I'm great.
You know, Coach, it was a while there as we started to get near the end of the season that I didn't think I was going to have you as a guest this year. I thought you were going to be there as a coach.
Yeah, you know, our players did a great job of bringing it home down the stretch. And then, you know, you battle and battle to get in. And then, you know, I never wanted to complain about seeds or draws or any of that. We've been to 20 NCAA tournaments, 13 straight. Only 7 teams in the country have gone to 13 straight tournaments. So I don't complain. I think if you spend time complaining about what your seed is, you overindulge in what your seed is, you underindulge in preparation. So I thought our players did a real good job as a 9 seed playing and beating a very good Minnesota team and Amanda Zowie B, who is already an AP All-American. And then, you know, Notre Dame was a tough call for us, and we didn't get the job done. Notre Dame is the second best team in the country by the committee's choice of them as a number 2, number 1 seed. So we lost a tough one, but a lot of people are losing tough ones to Notre Dame.
Well, Coach, you know, you're right about, you know, your thoughts about the seedings and how it can really create its own mindset. But I will say that I thought that the Big East Conference, I thought that you and Seton Hall both got jobbed this year, that both of you had tremendous seasons, you know, and co-champions for the conference to both end up with 9 seeds. I thought that was very disrespectful of what that conference did this year.
The Big East is a great, great conference, David, and it was great in its previous – it was great in the original configuration pre the development of UConn. It was great in the development of the great UConn program and all the other programs that were in it. It was great when, in 2006, so many of us, 5 or 6 schools, joined the Big East, and it's great today. And that's really, you know, you referenced that you thought – Seton Hall and DePaul got jobs. I really won't allow my mind to go there. It's our job to put the teams on the floor and play. I thought that St. John's and Villanova both belong in the NCAA tournament, and you know, that's where I thought our league really and truly didn't and isn't getting the respect that we deserve as we segue into this new conference alignment. I thought those two teams were really, really quality teams. Villanova opened the season on the road 7 or 8 games straight without 2 of their best players, and St. John's was playing well at the end of the year as well, you know, and had beaten some really pretty good teams, including a number 7 seed South Florida at South Florida. So I just thought, you know, I just think we have to really work to get our league the recognition it deserves. So I really believe in this Big East, and it's a truly special conference. Creighton got really good by the end, and so again, we could talk long and hard, but you just, when it's NCAA tournament time, take the draw you got, get your teams in the right frame of mind, and focus on the task at hand, and you know, when you're playing, you don't have time for anything else.
You know, Coach, we've talked before about, you know, a lot of these mid-major schools trying to get games against big teams, and you have been a very, very strong proponent of the larger conference schools playing these mid-majors and rewarding those that do and making it an important part of the scheduling process. You've also been the head of the WBCA. Is that something that the Coaches Association can get involved in? The committee certainly made their positions felt with Princeton being where their seed was, where – you know, I'm not going to include the Big East or the American Conference as mid-majors, but you guys, there were a lot of questionable seedings there and a lot of rewarding of teams that I'm not so sure deserved it. What can be done about forcing the issue about scheduling?
Well, there's two things going on right now. There's a two-pronged answer. First of all, the RPI right now is really askew because of the reconfiguration. When anybody looks at an RPI, the RPI has to have a beginning starting point at the beginning of the year. If everything was pure, you have 300 schools play at opening day, there's 150 that are 1-0 and 150 are 0-1, 300 schools play different teams on day two, you're going to have an equal amount of 2-0s, 0-2s, and 1-1s. And how can you have an RPI yet? How can you be determining strength of schedule without predetermining strength of schedule? This is the first year the tournament took teams, and I'm talking from the football five, with RPIs in the 50s and 60s. I mean, that's never happened before. And you're talking teams from the Southeastern Conference and the ACC that were in the NCAA tournament, justifiably so. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have been. I'm just making the point that, you know, this RPI thing is a good tool. It had its day, but I think it needs some really fine tuning right now, specifically with the realignment that's going on. A second place of your question, David, I have long maintained that I'm an advocate for, have been an advocate for, and always will be an advocate for what the NCAA can do about intercollegiate men's and women's scheduling is very simple. You make every team in the country play 30 games or 28 games, and you make the league schedule have to be what the league schedule is, determine it's going to be 16 or 18, and then the remaining, let's just say we play a 30-game schedule, 16 league games. You want to make it 18 league games, make it 18 league games. Then the 12 non-league games, 6 have to be at home and 6 have to be on the road. Once you do that, everybody across the board is going to have, you can still have the autonomy to schedule up, schedule down, but you're going to have, you know, it's the only major championship in American sport where somebody can be scheduling 19 home games or 20 home games out of 30 games, and another team having to schedule 10 home games out of 30 home games because that's just the way they've always done it. And, you know, that's just, it's really simple logic. You know, you don't get the Chicago Cubs. I'm a Cub fan. I drink Theo's Kool-Aid. They don't get to play 120 home games and, you know, 60 or 40 road games. You know, the Bears don't get to play, decide to schedule. We're going to schedule 12, 13 home games, only 4 road games. I mean, so that's how you solve the issue right there. You just make everybody have to play an equal amount of home and away games. You can develop a method to include the Hawaii and Maui, you know, the exotic trips to the Virgin Islands, which are TV-driven, you can still get those guys involved here and still include those into an equal balance of home and away games. And once you do that, then you're going to see Gino loves it. He said it out loud. He loved going over and playing Jen Rosati at Hartford. You know, and the place was packed, and it was just a great environment. And it was a great ball game. And UConn's not going to lose to Hartford at Hartford, but it still is a great, great game. So now North Carolina men have to go and play at East Carolina, or they got to go play at Coastal Carolina, or Virginia or West Virginia got to go play at another Division I school that's a road game. You know, and then it's going to make it even. Those that aren't going to argue, David, well, the teams that have to go on the road, they need the guarantees for their budget. Well, if you play a home game, it's going to pack the place because you got North Carolina or Duke coming in. That's the same as you're going to make the same money as you make on the guarantee. So that's a way to solve this, and that's just my take on it. So you got me on this show. You asked two questions, and you haven't had me shut up yet.
That's why I have you on. This way I wind you up and let you go. You make hosting easy.
Well, no, it's really simple logic, and it's amazing to hear the coaches. You know, some of them argue for it. Some of them are anti it because they're in a place where they can have 19 home games, buy wins, make money on the home crowd, and then some of them have become dependent on the guarantee money, take the loss and get the guarantee money. But those same teams that take the loss and get the guarantee money, you know, you start scheduling some, and that forces people to have to draw at home. You know, put some pressure on people, men and women, to draw fans. So you want to make the money of the guarantee, make the money of bringing people into your arena, and make the ticket money.
All of which makes perfect sense, doesn't it? You know, you would think that more people would buy into it, but it troubles me based on, especially on the logic that you very profoundly stated there, that on the conference call with the committee that Drew Hancock commented to Graham Hayes that the committee didn't even look at the fact that Princeton played as many games on the road or on neutral sites, that it didn't even come up. So, I mean, if these people have to go on the road, then you at least have to give them a little bit of credit for doing it.
For sure. And again, I think the RPI has to, I mean, it was a great tool when it began. I think it's been a real nice tool. But, I mean, why has ESPN come out with their power rankings, their BPI? Because once we're going to start crunching the numbers, let's start really crunching the numbers. Because, you know, it's not the only mathematical formula I think we've become a little bit too dependent on it, especially in this time of conference change, because there were some amazing, weird teams that played really good people and had some really good wins that still had some really fractured RPIs. And, you know, it was just a weird year RPI-wise. And it's amazing how some teams were really high at the beginning. And we've been helped by this in some years, Dave. You know, some years DePaul has started the season and all of a sudden it's four games in and we're 16 or something. And I don't know how. We played four games or six games or 10 games. You know, even when they say, you don't start the RPI until after 10 games, I'll make that argument. Still in the 10 games, you had to, you know, if you understand the formula, you know, the your wins, you know, the wins of your opponents, and the strength of schedule of the opponents. How do you determine strength of schedule at the beginning of the year when nobody's played yet? it's unless you preconceive something, unless you're preconceiving that certain teams are stronger than other teams, you can't have a strength of schedule until at least, you know, more than 10 games are played. So there's some basic flaws in the RPI system that I think need to get addressed.
I would agree with that. So, we could spend hours on this topic alone. So let's move on and let's talk first. Before we get into the Final Four, let's talk about your team a little bit. And you know, it was a great year. You had some incredible games. You had some great leadership out of a couple of seniors, and of course, the dreaded ACL struck, as it always seems to do these days to somebody. But you had a young team, and you know, Brittany is just a phenomenal talent that we'll see in the WNBA. And it does seem though that you guys seem to get more than your fair share of crucial injuries when it heads towards the postseason.
David, the injuries to Mega. Well, first of all, Brittany Renko had a really, really exceptional year, and she was, she really just did a great job. And I think we got to talk about Centrice McGee, our other senior besides Megan Rogalski, who went down with the ACL on January 2nd. She went down early in the, she only played one and a half Big East games this season. And Megan Rogalski was one of the best guards in the country, finishing last season when we had the upset of Duke at Duke. So, it's tough. And, and one of the things I hate the most about coaching, I don't hate anything about coaching except watching a player get injured. And it happens to us, and it happens to a lot of people across the country. And it's just one of those things that you just can't stand about coaching. But Brittany Renko had a great year. And, so did Centrice McGee. Juniors, Megan Pinkola, who ended up being the outstanding player in the Big East tournament, really turned it on at the end of the season. Shanice Jenkins, another a very talented guard, had a very special year. And Jessica January, a sophomore, did a really, really good job, a really, really strong competitive job. So, you know, we were second, third, somewhere in the top five for sure in assists. We always try to lead the nation in assists. And yet we had three guards with great numbers on the assist front. And so it was a good, strong team. I'm proud of the way the team came together. We really felt for Megan Rogowski losing her to the ACL.
Yeah, but, you know, Rogowski follows Martin, who follows Hampton. You know, you guys...
Who follows Dot, who follows Dot.
It's unbelievable how it seems to keep happening to you guys.
Well, it happens to everybody, but it just seems to have happened to our best players. I mean, these are... And Rogowski, I mean, Brett Riegel was our best player, but believe me, you know, Rogowski was right there with
yeah.
You know, Brett was our best player. I'm not trying to say Rogowski...
No, Rogowski was a crucial part, though. Yeah, no question about it.
They complemented each other so well. Rogowski's presence made Britt better, and Britt's abilities made Rogowski better. So, you know, you just didn't lose a player. You lost you lost something that a synergy to our team that never gets fixed.
Well, it was the team did still go have an incredible run. You won like 15 or 16 games, at, you know, like 15 out of 16 towards the end there. But, you know, the one big game that everybody goes back to this year, you came up in today's press conferences apparently too, was the Notre Dame game back in December. Somebody had asked Coach McGraw today if there was a moment this year where the team was at the crossroads where it could have gone either way. And she said, yeah, the DePaul game after we came back and won that game after losing to UConn. She said that she thought that, you know, being able to win that game really made a difference as a kind of a launching point for the success Notre Dame had the rest of the year.
Well, Notre Dame's really, really a good basketball team, and you know, we played, you know, it was one of those situations where your free throws win games, free throws win close games, and we didn't have a great free throw night that night. It was really a fractured free throw night, but we also did some things that were really kind to Notre Dame down the stretch, and believe me, Notre Dame played a great game. Jewel Lloyd had 41. Madison Cable had a senior coming out game. I think she's had a solid career, but she had a big, big night. Don't forget Notre Dame played us back on December 10th without Turner. Turner was not in that game. And so, you know, Cable played, and they played with four guards, which is probably beneficial to how you need to play against us because Coach McGraw played our tournament game much of the time with four guards on the floor as well. So it was a good game for Notre Dame. You know, I thought that we had an 8-point lead with about 6 minutes to go and didn't do a great job of hanging on to it. And at the same time, that's what free throws determine that too. So at any rate, we put ourselves in position to actually beat Notre Dame. Notre Dame got the win that night and went on to have a great year. And I think that's a statement and a testament to Jewel Lloyd because Jewel, you know, Notre Dame had other really, really good players, Turner and Reimer, and then, you know, Cable and Mabry and Allen really played well here in the tournament. So that's still a really, really strong Notre Dame team. And when it's all said and done, you know, Jewel's going to be a great pro. Turner's going to be a pro. Allen looks starting to look like she's going to be a pro. And, you know, maybe Reimer is also. And so it's a really, really good basketball team, and Muffet's done a great job with that team.
Well, yes, you had the misfortune of having to get them in the tournament as well after playing them that first time. And, you know, Jewel did struggle in that game. She shot only 3 of 15. But as you mentioned, you know, Mabry, you know, had 19 points in that game. And the bigs, Turner and Reimer, really, they come this postseason, they've really asserted themselves as dominant forces. I mean, both of them had double-doubles against you guys.
Yeah, they're very special, and yeah, I don't think our pressure was its wisest. I don't feel like we played a really, really solid game against Notre Dame, and you always have to give the opponent credit when you don't play well. You know, it's not just you not playing well, it's the opponent making you not play well. And Reimer and Turner were big reasons in that basketball game. And Jewel might have struggled against us in that game, but I mean, for her career, she's had a great career against DePaul. She had, like I said, the 41 and the overtime game in December against us. And she had a huge game a couple of years ago. She had a huge couple other games against us as well. So Jules had a great career against us.
Coach, Jules had a great career against everybody. Even when she's not shooting, she makes such a difference because you always have to respect her no matter where she is on the court. She opens things up so well for that, for them. So let's segue into how a team like South Carolina lines up against them. They have all those bigs in Carolina, and then you've got one spectacular athlete in Tiffany Mitchell who is probably going to go head-to-head with Jewel and try and defend her.
Tiffany Mitchell is another special player that really comes up big at crunch time, but she's big all game. And so I think the unsung hero on that South Carolina team, I mean, everybody knows about Coates and Wilson and the size of their interior game. But, you know, I love the Wilson kid. I mean, I just think that's one of the most special players in America. And, you know, she's probably going to be passed over for most All-American teams because she's your classic jack of all trades but master of none. But she's just a really special combative, competitive player. I was lucky enough to be at the UConn-South Carolina game in stores because they were, you know, making the announcement about the assistant coaches for the Olympic team that night. And, you know, we had Dawn there. So Cheryl Reeves and I were there as well. And the NCAA, we actually watched the game with Gino and Dawn's permission to watch the game live that night. So I got to see the February 9th South Carolina UConn game. And Welsh is really something else. I mean, she's really a good player, as is Tiffany Mitchell. And Tiffany Mitchell, I don't mean to minimize talking about her because she's really a special guard as well. And so when you know, the heart and soul of that team is Mitchell. But, boy, you can't forget about Welsh. And then, you know, the coach and Asia Wilson comes off the bench and can really get going and get off as well. So it's a really good basketball team that Tom's bringing to the Final Four. And yet, you know, they escaped. So let's not forget that they played some. When I say they escaped, I'm trying to say it as a compliment to South Carolina because, you know, they really had to come back and play well at the end to beat North Carolina. They had to come back and play well at the end to beat a very, very talented Florida State team just to get here.
You know, I agree that agree about Welsh. One place where she is, I don't think will be overlooked, will be the WNBA draft. I think that she will be going pretty high in the first round, assuming that people appreciate all the things that you just mentioned, because she is just a joy to watch, I have to admit. Mitchell's athleticism is a blast, and I love watching the big shots, but you're right about, I agree, Welsh is the glue on that team. Let's talk about Dawn for a second, though. You know, people had questioned, you know, she's built an incredible program there. There's no question about it that the building aspects. You've coached alongside of her now with USA Basketball. And, of course, you've known her as a player over the years and through all of the other gyrations that she's done. How has Dawn Staley developed herself as a coach over the years? Because she's still the least experienced of the people that are now in the Final Four as a coach.
Yeah, Dawn, first of all, she's a player. You know, what I love about Dawn and Jen Rosati, two former great, great players, they've rolled up their sleeves to be coaches as true, from the ground up, foundation coaches. You know, there's a lot of great players and a lot of professional players that think this coaching gig, this college coaching gig, is easy. And Dawn works. You know, what can I say about Dawn is that she works. She doesn't just think, I'm Dawn Staley, I'm a pro, I'm an icon. Even though she is Dawn Staley, she is a great pro, she is an icon, she works. And she just, you know, she just rolls up her sleeves like anybody else that gets good in this profession and goes to work. And I just think that's, you know, I think that's the telling point. And you know, I reference Jen with her because Jen isn't in a conference like the Atlantic Coast Conference and the Southeastern Conference is where Dawn's at. But, you know, these players there's some players that just think they walk in and show up for practice. I was with, I forget who I was talking to the other day, but somebody, you know, thinks that, you know, maybe was being involved with our men's search, and a lot of professional names came up and we have a lot of talented professional former men's players at DePaul that have had some nice pro careers. And yet when you come to the college level, it's a sport where I don't think any college coach can just go to the NBA and be any good without a good 3 to 6 year apprenticeship on an NBA bench. And likewise, I don't think any pro coach can just come to college and be a great college coach, even though it's both basketball, without a good, strong apprenticeship about what – it's not about the game of basketball once the ball's thrown up. It's about every single thing else that's involved with your day that's going to drive you. You have to do it, all these other things. You have to do it well. You have to care for your student-athletes' welfare, first and foremost. You have to take care of your students as students, first and foremost. You have to recruit, which is a nonstop activity. And, you know, getting into the gym and being able to have those 2 hours in the gym, that's the easy part of the day. You have to put a staff together. You have to manage a staff. It's you know, I think the world of Chris Mullin, and I think Chris is a really solid hire for St. John's, but Chris has got to get himself surrounded by quality collegiate people, and Chris has got to get his head around, you know, hopefully he'll be able to get his head around quickly, because he's a Big East guy, and I want all Big East guys to be good. So I want Chris to succeed at St. John's, but he's got to get his head around real quick and fast about what this collegiate thing's all about. The men in the NBA have a whole different challenge than we have. Working, you know, talking to old Ricky Majerus about going from Marquette to the NBA or Marquette to Ball State to the NBA with the Bucks, you know, 120 games a year, night in and night out, that grind. It's a different grind in and of itself than the collegiate grind, which is only 30, 35, 40 games if you can last that long. But it's everything else you got to do. I mean, Chris Mullin doesn't have to go sit when he's the general manager in the NBA. He doesn't have to go talk to alumni. He doesn't have to beg, borrow, and steal to get people to come to the games. He doesn't have to go to lunches and talk to people, sit with board of trustees. I mean, just all these other things you have to do. You know, that's just where the college game gets the pro guys, and then the pro game gets the college guys. Both require a real learning curve. It's not like NFL guys can go to college and college football guys can go to the NFL, and it's a simple transformation. It's not the same in basketball.
And now the other side of that, you created a program at DePaul, you know, from the ground up. You've, you know, built it into a culture, the type of person you want, the type of people that you have coming to the program. And then you've sold that program to Chicago and convinced them that you're a team that's worthy of spending their entertainment dollars, and they come out and you draw. And Dawn has managed to do that in South Carolina, whereas a lot of people have not been able to do that. What is it about? Is it just her personality? Is it just that work ethic that you're talking about, that she relates, that the people relate to her, that she can get out there and get them to draw? Why is she more successful than some other people have been, as you were?
David, I apologize for the answer to the last question, because I got off Dawn and I got on an NBA tirade, so I apologize for that.
That's no problem. We could always talk about. We could always go back and talk about Gino's comment today about and men's basketball being terrible. So
let's stay with Dawn first. Dawn, there is a personality there, and yeah, there is. She makes it. Yeah, she goes into Columbia and she makes it a thing to do. I mean. And it's, everybody thinks it, and it looks now, looking back from this Final Four backwards, if I'm correct, I think she's been there 7 years already. And it seems like she's only been there a couple, but this is a seven-year build, you know, and so she's gone out and she's gotten great kids. She's worked it to get great kids, great players. She had the guts to say no to a player that wasn't behaving exactly her. You know, she said she had a player that she let leave that became a great player in another program. But it takes guts to do that, and I admire her for that. I think that's one of the most telling things about Dawn, that it's about the program. It's about doing things the right way, getting out there in the community and working in the community. You know, I'm sure that's what she's done in South Carolina to get people to come to the game. I talk about, you know, getting people to watch women's basketball. I believe in women's basketball. I think it's a great sport. I think it's great to watch. But it's amazing how people the sporting fan in America, you know, has a basic beginning bias against it, because women are compared and juxtaposed to the extraordinary talent of the male player. And I would never want to take away from that extraordinary talent of the male player, but that doesn't mean the female talent, the talent of the female player isn't still a strong and different kind of talent. So it just takes that much more work to get the paying sports paying public to come watch a women's basketball game. And Dawn's taken the Columbia, South Carolina community, she's galvanized it, she's turned it into the Gamecock Nation, and those people want to come watch it, and she's done it brick by brick, slowly, and from the bottom up, just as Geno did at Storrs. Nobody wanted to go near UConn as a women's basketball coach when Geno took the job. He built it from the ground up, brick by brick, player by player, team by team, and that's what Dawn's doing in South Carolina, and she's doing a magnificent job with it.
Okay, so let's double back then. Let's finish with this one first. So so South Carolina faces off against Notre Dame. What are your thoughts on this matchup, and what do you think each has to do to beat the other?
Well, you know, again, because Notre Dame comes from my backyard, and because I'm so close to Jewel, having known her since she's a little young child, you know, there's that built-in bias. I work with Dawn, so of course, I like Dawn from being on the staff with her, and yet it's hard not to be. And let's just also say, because DePaul got beat by Notre Dame, when you get beat in this tournament, and remember, 63 teams do get beat, you want to get beat by the team that goes the furthest. You want the team that beats you to go the furthest. So there's a built-in bias to my answer to the question. So you have to understand that. So I think it's going to be a great, great matchup, because of the fact that, you know, Notre Dame does have Jewel and South Carolina does have Tiffany Mitchell. The battle in the paint is going to be a great battle. You know, again, Turner is really getting better with every game that she plays. Reimer is really starting to play, you know, down the stretch here, and yet they're going to have their hands full with the great interior game of South Carolina. And then, you know, the X factor then becomes people like Cable for Notre Dame and Mabry for Notre Dame and Welch for South Carolina. You know, those are the X factor players. And you know, I think it's just going to be a great ball game. And I know when you turn from coach to prognosticator, you're supposed to pick them. So I guess right now I'm going to go with Notre Dame because, you know, again, they're in our backyard and they beat us. And I want everybody to understand that's why I'm picking Notre Dame, pulling for Notre Dame, so that Notre Dame's in the championship game.
Sounds good to me. Coach, you're allowed to be biased in this. We don't claim to be impartial here. Okay, so Geno ruffles feathers again today. He talks about how the men's game is terrible as a spectator, how they shoot poorly, and that he doesn't understand. He said that the women's game is behind the times too, with the way that they don't have enough offense, but the men's game is even further behind. It's about time for Geno. It's Final Four time, so it's time for Geno to say something to start deflecting from his players, right?
Well, I don't think Geno just does that, but at the same time, I think Geno has. It's a time of the year. Everybody thinks that's what's going on, David, but, you know, it's a time of the year where the media is constantly asking questions. You know, it's when these answers come out, nobody remembers that the fact that they were asked questions. Like all the brouhaha a year ago, you know, the questions were asked and then answered. So I don't think Geno deliberately goes in to try to stir things up. I think he gets asked questions, answers them straightforwardly, and when he answers them straightforwardly, because he is who he is, and he's achieved what he's achieved, then his, you know, his comments, you know, get moved. And I mean, I think I haven't seen it yet, but somebody has already tweeted or called me and said that Jay Billis said something like, Gino's right. You know, he might have been a little harsh, but he was right.
Yep.
So, you know, it's Gino's not the first person to talk about men's college basketball becoming such a low-scoring affair. I mean, that's, you know, Freddie Hoiberg said that on game day. I remember watching Freddie on game day back when they're getting ready to play Kansas, you know, back in January. So this isn't just coming from Gino Auriemma. It's coming from people on the men's side. It's coming from people that watch men's basketball. So Gino's saying it today, but he's just echoing what a lot of people have been saying.
Hey.
Why is it? Because you can't score if you don't shoot. All right? And coaches being what they tend to be, they want to be perfect. They want to get the perfect shot. They know if they get a shot, what is a good shot? It's a shot that has the best chance of going in. Well, you got to have people that can make shots outside of 2 or 3 feet to be able to shoot the ball. I mean, the Notre Dame-Kentucky game the other night on the men's side was a classic for a reason. Mike Bray coached his game, and he's collected a team at Notre Dame on the men's side that shoots and scores the basketball at five positions, spaces the floor, spreads the floor, can score the ball out on the you know, from the perimeter on into the rim and from the rim back out to the perimeter. So it was a game that there's a reason it was a classic. And so that's what we see when we coach in Europe and coach Europe against European teams. Everybody can make a shot, and everybody can make a three-point shot. So if you have players that can shoot the ball and make shots, it's why Dayton played such a nice ball game for a half the other day against UConn, because they have players that can make shots. So that's what I think Gino's trying to make the statement about. And, you know, when I watch a men's game, I sit there and say, if I was coaching this men's team, would I have let the kid take that shot or that shot? And I usually find five shots in a possession I would have let my player take that might have been argued, not a perfect shot. But then at the end of the 35 seconds, they're taking a bad shot anyway. So you know, okay, if you're going to take a bad shot at the end of 35, why not let the kids be free to take some shots earlier in the possessions? And that's where, you know, Freddie Hoiberg said it, and Gino, and I know Gino thinks it, and I think it. Let's just go like, let's go 24-8 here, make it universal, and guess what? You're going to have to find shots earlier. You're going to have to shoot the ball more freely. And you go 24-8, and 12-year-old girls, 10-year-old girls play 24-8 over in Croatia and Lithuania and all over the world. So, you know, if 10 and 8 and 9, 10-year-old girls could play at 24-second clock and an 8-second clock and be pretty good at it, men's college basketball can too. So, you know, that's really what we're talking about here.
I agree 100%. And, of course, I was being facetious when I made the comment about he's saying this to tell people because, of course, as you know, I cover Connecticut and we're used to hearing stuff like this from Gino up here. Yeah, but this is when the national media gets to hear them, and all of a sudden, instead of just our local papers and such, now it starts making the front page of ESPN.com and things like that. But what I enjoy most about Connecticut and watching them closely and covering them, of course, is, as you mentioned, the ability to play basketball. You know, Gino will run some plays and he'll call some offenses, but, you know, it seems so many teams, you see the ball, they come up, they look over to the coach, when are we going to run this time? Connecticut just goes out there and plays the game. And I think that's part of what makes them such a difficult team to play against.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think the reason for the Connecticut success is, you know, it's threefold. I mean, I think first of all, you start with a great coach. You know, and people ask me all the time, why is, you know, what makes UConn so good? Well, I mean, Gino and his staff. I mean, so you got Gino and his staff. Those are two ingredients right there. You know, he's got a great staff, Chris and Shay and Marissa and everybody on the staff, Sarah, you know, Kathy Auriemma, everybody. His staff is a great staff. So, and then Gino is a great coach. and they work diligently day in and day out, practice in and practice out, to help make their players get better. No player is brought there and is allowed to be satisfied with where they're at. The job is to get you better every minute of every practice till the day you're done. All right, that's one, you know, a couple of reasons. The players Gino recruits and his staff recruits make shots, and he's got a knack for understanding the talent he wants to coach. He's not just bringing in long, tall kids that can run and jump. He's bringing in kids that often happen to be long, often happen to be tall, often happen to be able to jump, that are basket makers. They make baskets. They score the ball. And then he and his staff help them get better at how they score the ball. They share the basketball. And so, and then what I always call and I always reference, and back when we got beat by them, you know, in Bridgeport in December, I think it was December 19th, I said afterwards in the press conference that the national championship is going to go through UConn. Yeah, the dirty little secret is UConn plays great defense. And, you know, you're going to have a game. You know, Coach Bruno here hasn't coached six games in the NCAA tournament yet, but you're going to have a game if you have six games to coach in the NCAA tournament where you're not going to have your highest level of edge and crank on. And I think that's what you saw in the first half of the Dayton game. Dayton is a really good basketball team. But George Washington did beat him three times this year. Let's not forget that GW, you know, won the A-10, and GW did beat Dayton three times. So UConn's first half defense wasn't quite at its highest level of UConn crank. And, you know, Dayton's a really good team that can make shots. And the Dayton program seized on that, and that's why it was 44-43 at halftime. You come out of that halftime, and it was UConn defensive lockdown. And, you know, the subtle adjustment or simple adjustment of switching ball. Now, when you play against UConn, you're playing, you're trying to find shots. Yeah, you got to stop them, which is a task that's very difficult. But you still have to find looks at the basket. You know, I was totally demoralized when we got beat 98-64 by 34 points on December 19th. But then I'm watching number one South Carolina get beat by almost the same score, not quite, but pretty close to the same score. And you're talking the number one team in the nation. And why did that happen? Because of the defensive ability of Connecticut. They are a great defensive team. They turned the defense back on in the second half. Gino got the ball in the paint, which is, again, he's a great coach. He understands he's got a feel for the game. He can see what's going on, figure out what's going on. He's got the ability to fix what's going on. And, you know, they slowed down ever so slightly in the second half, got the ball inside where they needed to get the ball, took away all looks at the basket for Dayton. And, you know, all of a sudden it's a 20-point basketball game. And I'm happy that it was close enough for people around the country to be thrilled by the score and that they could watch it for 30 minutes or so. But it could have been worse. Let's not forget, it could have been worse. So that's, you know, this is a great UConn program again.
Yeah, Stewart and Lloyd can both make the claim for being player of the year, and I'm certainly not going to get into that debate. You look at Stewart and the development that she's had over the couple of years. You know, what always intrigues me is, you know, Maya and, you know, some of the other All-Americans that have been there. Diana's the only other one that I can recall that just when the calendar flipped over to March, they seemed to have another level of intensity like Stewart has.
I think that's a very accurate statement, David. And, you know, the other thing that, you know, to me, these players are 1 and 1A because Stewie and Jewel are both two special, special players. And sometimes in your career as a basketball player, you happen to come along at a time where, you know, there's somebody else that happens to be there. And, you know, Lou Gehrig played for the Yankees and there wasn't a Babe Ruth. You know, that just sometimes happens. And, you know, the impact on the game that Stewie has. You know, even when Stewie is in Gino's doghouse or maybe floundering for her and not maybe as focused as she might be able to be like she is in March, she's still having colossal impact on the game, even if she's not scoring a point. Her length, her ability to block shots, change shots, to defend, to rebound. There's so much impact on the game that Breanna Stewart has when she's not knocking down her threes. We happened to get her in Bridgeport after a tough game where she was knocking down threes, where she's knocking down shots. And you know, when she's knocking down shots and she's doing everything else, wow. You know, it's just really, really special. Even I remember last year coming out of the regional with the buzz here, or was in Nashville. The buzz was, you know, Stewie had a tough regional. She wasn't, you know, she still had major impact against BYU, and BYU played a game a little bit like Dayton last year where they hung for a half, and then Texas A&M played a pretty respectable game against Connecticut, and everybody's buzzing Stewie's not herself, but she's still, the impact that she has in the game that doesn't show up. She fills a stat sheet as it is, but when she just has great impact on the game. And that's the thing about Jewel. Jewel does too. Jewel has great impact on the game. Jewel's going through right now probably her greatest offensive struggle in her time at Notre Dame, certainly this year. And yet she still impacts the game as well. Probably Stewie impacts it a little bit more just because of her size and her ability to change shots, alter shots, you know, longer length into the passing lanes defensively. But Jewel does impact the game off the ball defensively, off the ball getting to rebounds, you know, making people have to guard her, you know, in so many different ways. You know, we're proud of the fact that we held Jewel to 3-for-15 shooting in our NCAA game, but we also, by focusing on Jewel, let Mabry have a night of her life. So that's Mabry knocking them down, but she's not open without Jewel. So both of these players are special, and Stewie is, you know, just really, really, really just got this great, great impact on the game that you know.
Every year, Brenda Freeze seems to take a team that people don't necessarily expect to be in the top four or five teams of the year at the start of the year, and they change things up, or they lose an Alyssa Thomas, and they go with all these sophomores this year, and there they are. They're athletic. They're long. They play fast. They've got the punt. Do they have a puncher's chance at UConn?
You know, it's why we play. I think everybody's got a chance at everybody. Again, pointing back to the Kentucky Notre Dame men's game the other evening, I think everybody always has a chance. And I think Brenda does a great job of believing. You can't win without believing you can win. And I think Brenda is awesome as a coach and as a leader in getting her team here year in and year out. You know, she's starting to remind on the women's side, like Tommy Izzo on the men's side, that, you know, it's just, they just bring a toughness to it. They just have a feel for March, have a feel for how to get their team together and ready, focused. And you know, I saw Notre Dame beat Maryland early in the season by about 25. It was the game before we played Notre Dame, if I'm not mistaken. No, I guess it was UConn. It was right before us. But, you know, I watched Maryland, and Turner got hurt in that game and didn't even play. And Notre Dame still just picked Maryland apart. And I thought, wow, this is going to be – I think they're going to be good in the Big Ten, but I think they're going to have – you know, it's not going to be one of Maryland's better years. And, wow, they just ran through the Big Ten, and the next thing you know, they're running through the NCAA first two rounds, and now they're in the Final Four. And I think that's a tribute to Brenda and the job that she and her staff do, sitting there just finishing chairing the All-American Committee for the WBCA. There's no way I'm going to talk about, nor am I allowed to talk about, what went on in that room. But I think it's safe to say that, you know, there's a lot of players from a lot of other teams that got a lot more discussion than the kids from Maryland. And that's a statement about the coaching staff, because, you know, that's, You know, this is kind of a, of course we know about Lexi Brown, but it's not a team filled with household names, and that makes it a tribute to what Brenda's done. And they did a great job in the Big Ten. And the Big Ten was a good league this year. You know, Iowa was strong. Ohio State came on strong at the end. You had a top 25 team in Northwestern. Those were the top four seeds, and they got seven teams into the NCAA tournament. So, you know, that was a strong, it ended up being a strong league this year. So, and that's a tribute to Maryland and what Brenda did, that they could run away with that league.
And there's no question about it that, you know, it's intriguing to me when I see a team that has the athleticism and the fact that they're so young and they don't seem to be intimidated by anybody, which I think is really, you know, important. You know, the question, because we always hear about how people are intimidated by the UConn jersey sometimes, and it'll be interesting to see what happens when Maryland sets foot on the court there. I think that most people would presume that Connecticut advances to the finals. I'll ask you the question. I assume that that's the way that you're going on this one?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think Maryland's going to come out swinging and come out fighting and really have the toughness to fight and compete with UConn. But in the end, you still have to, you know, you have to get looks, and you have to get good looks, and then you have to make shots. And I just really think that UConn's, you know, this is, I keep going back to UConn's defense, and I think that's really where they're special. And that's why I'm just such a so high on UConn. I didn't coach against Maryland this year, but I did coach against both Notre Dame, and I did coach against UConn. So I did coach against both those two schools. So I'm picking a UConn-Notre Dame final, and then I'm picking UConn to win the national championship again. So that's, you know, I think Geno gets number 10 this year, and I just think that's the way this thing is going to move.
Close game?
Classic. I think the South Carolina Notre Dame game is going to be a great game. I think the UConn-Maryland game is going to be a grinder. And then I think the UConn-Notre Dame game is going to – I don't think it's going to be a blowout, but I think it's going to be a solid UConn win by the end. But I think Notre Dame is going to keep it a game for a good long time.
How big a difference does Breanna Turner make compared to the game where UConn played them earlier without her?
I think she's huge. I mean, she's a great rebounder. She's so long, quick, athletic to the rim. Great, great rebounder, great competitor, and a great finisher at the basket. You know, her one place of needed growth right now is Muffet's used to having big players whereby and through her offense can run. You know, when you have Julie, you say, how can an offense run through your big guys? But don't forget, you know, they had Skylar and McBride and Jewel all on the same team, and they still, you know, used Achunwa very, very effectively in that pinch post area. So Reimer is very effective in that pinch post area, whereas Turner's just so much more a power player. And yet, you know, I think it's going to make a huge difference for Muffet to be able to have and Turner on the floor at the same time. That neutralizes, you know, the strength of Brianna. But don't forget, you talk about UConn, and nobody even talks about Kia Stokes. You know, Kia Stokes is going to be drafted probably in the top 10 picks here next week, and a week and a half from now. So, you know, if Geno has to pull Kia Stokes out of his hat and go big, he's going to be able, he's definitely going to be able to do so. So I just think that's where, you know, the Turner factor is going to be really important. But I think, you know, let's not forget about Stokes coming out here as the season comes along.
Coach, I also, congratulations on the USA return gig. It's always great to have you as part of USA basketball, all of the coaching staff. Vegas, huh? Better than Bridgeport again.
I'm honored, and, you know, I think another thing that's really good about what Geno figures out about life, and this is Carol Callen and USA basketball also, it's just amazing how we get a better player turnout when we train in Vegas. You know, there's just something about Vegas over Stores, or something about Vegas over Hartford, or something about Vegas over Colorado Springs that just seems to bring our athletes together.
Gee, I can't understand that at all.
And the Mayweather Pacquiao fight is actually May 2nd. We get there May 3rd, so you know there's going to be a lot of things going on there. But we're looking forward to May 3rd to May 7th, really getting on the floor and seeing you know how our players have developed and you know the development and changes in our players and watching that development and growth and development and in some cases aging. You know, there's some players are growing and developing and emerging and growing into their peak level, and some are actually growing out of their peak level. And you know, that's just something that we have to observe and keep an eye on. But you know, one player I don't think is growing out of her peak level, and that's the ageless wonder of the UConn backcourt of Diana and Sue. Those two seem to be ageless. So it'll be fun to see how another year of European basketball is taking its toll on these great and talented women.
Well, you know, it'll be, you know, you're nearing that point, though. You guys are going to have some tough calls. Sue, Diana, Tamika, they're all getting up there. You know, it's going to be time for youth to be served pretty soon, I'm afraid.
It's going to be time for youth to be served. I'm just telling you right now, if you got to go into any dark alley in any place in the world, you want those to be with you. You know, you talk about you have catchings, you have Diana, you have Sue with you. You know you're coming out of that alley. So those are really three tough players. Let's not leave our friend Simone out of that too. I mean, you keep talking, there's just a lot of players to talk about.
There sure is. Well, Coach, you know, thanks again for taking the time. You know, it's become an annual rite of passage that I love looking forward to, is talking to you before the Final Four, and I appreciate you taking time. I know how busy you are down in Tampa.
David, thank you, and you know what? As I just completed talking about those four in the dark alley, let's take Maya Moore in that dark alley with us, okay? thank you very much.
Well, wait a minute. If we're going to do that, can we put Brittany in front?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Take care, Doug. Thanks again.
Again, thanks for all you do for the sport of women's basketball. And if I blab on too long and too long, that's life. No problem.
Take care, Doug.